Hello and welcome to the Classic Car Weekly podcast. We're back for an election special. I'm the title's staff writer, Jesse Billington, and I'm joined by the editor, David Simister. How are you?
I'm good. Looking forward to what I think could be potentially quite an interesting general election this week. There's been obviously a lot of chatter over the in the national newspapers and online, so I'm genuinely looking forward to what could be one of the most exciting and important general elections potentially in a generation.
Certainly in my lifetime, at least, I think we've got a very exciting sort of 3 or 4 days coming up. We're, of course, recording this in the sort of CCW towers on Wednesday morning. So hopefully this will be out and you'll be able to enjoy this as you go to the polling stations on Thursday. And with the election right around the corner, we've put together some neutral points to bear in mind before you put a tick in any specific box. And we're not going to suggest voting for any specific parties or candidates. Think of this more as just some policies we'd address if we were actually standing. There'll be no microphone muting. There'll be no milkshake throwing here. So obviously, we know the election's around the corner. That's one of the obvious reasons why we've started this podcast and this little conversation. But I think you've got some points as to why we want to really delve into this now, haven't you?
Absolutely. So, one of the things that I often, we report on politics quite regularly in Classic Car Weekly, and sometimes we'll get emails to the effect of, well, you know, this is all about, it's a hobby for me. I don't really want to read about what's happening at Westminster. But actually, the decisions taken in Westminster and Whitehall can have quite a big effect on what happens to the Classic Car movement. And while we're not going to say today you should vote for any one party in particular, or say that any one party has particular policies that may or may not help Classic Car enthusiasts, in fact, if anything, most of the manifestos don't have many classic specific policies in them at this stage, because they're obviously trying to appeal to a much wider part of the electorate. But this is more of a sort of friendly reminder to whoever gets into number 10 on Friday that we are a very significant hobby. We have more than 1.5 million historic vehicles on Britain's roads, and they contribute a significant amount to Britain's economy. So it's just, again, talking about why our hobby is important and how politics can have an impact on them.
I think when you put it into the context of, I think we're, as a hobby, we're bigger than fishing and bigger than golf, I want to say as well, possibly.
Yes, there was I remember having a conversation with the Wheeler Dealers Duo, and again, one of the things that came out of that was that actually Britain's historic vehicle movement is actually a bigger hobby economically than golf is. So, again, massively important to Britain.
Yeah, so when you think about all those people that are out on golfing courses, when you sort of drive through the countryside, rolling green hills, and you see people in the far sort of distance with their buggies and bags, you think, see a lot of them about. Bear in mind, there's more value in classic cars than there is in all of them. So it's a big hobby, and certainly one the government could do with sitting up and listening to for a little bit. And I think we'll delve into some of the points as to why they ought to sit up and listen. I think the first point I'd like to open with is the DVLA consultation. That's closed now, and the FBHBC have submitted their response, and I hope really that plenty of other classic motorists in the UK have too. The real question I think we ought to ask is, what happens now to all the data they've collected?
Well, interestingly, the DVLA is a call to evidence, and this is how the DVLA handles cases involving classic car owners, and it actually closes on the same day as the general election. So this coming Thursday, 4th of July, if you've already been to the polling station, or perhaps you're on your way, if you haven't responded yet, there's still time. You can still go into the DVLA's website and respond to that call for evidence. And this is a really big piece of work that's being done to look at how the DVLA responds specifically to cases involving not just classic cars, but historic vehicles. These are the cars that are exempt from taxes, from MOTs, from most city centre emission zones. And the ongoing piece of feedback from the industry, certainly in the time that I've been on Classic Car Weekly, is that historic vehicles might make up a relatively small proportion of the DVLA's casework, but the agency has difficulties in dealing with some of the more nuanced cases involving historic vehicles. So we're talking about things like registering vehicles after registrations. We're talking about changes to vehicles. And we've had quite a big pushback over the years involving classic car owners who've been tying themselves up in knots, going back and forth with the letters and phone calls between themselves and Swansea. Cars have been kept off the roads. They've not been put in the correct tax class. All sorts of things, because the problem is the agency doesn't have the expertise in-house to deal with these quite complicated cases. So the FBHVC, this is the Federation of British Historic Vehicle Clubs, and the HCVA, this is the Historic Classic Vehicle Association. They've done a lot of work, these two organisations in particular, in bringing these cases to the attention of MPs. And what they're looking for is for clubs and classic car experts in particular to be much more involved when these cases do pop up, so that we don't end up with cases where classic cars are left off the road.
Yeah, I think one of the important things to note about submitting evidence is it's not a long-winded process, but there's a lot of questions. You don't have to answer all of them. Only answer the ones that you sort of had an interaction with, where you've got something to add to it. It still counts towards the overarching sort of pile of evidence. So don't sort of look at it and sort of panic, thinking that's a lot to deal with. Answer the bits you know, answer the bits where you've had problems, and get it in. But I think overall, we want, once this evidence is collated, whichever party we see sort of take hold of the reins, we want them to sort of sit down with all party group for classic vehicles, isn't it, and sort of the overarching groups, HCVA, FBHVC, and go, right, this is what's been said, how can we do something? I think this is, it's going to be maybe a few months down the line, but we want that to happen, that case of the transport secretary sits down and goes, right, what do we need to do now? That's something we sort of, we want to see happen further down the line. To an important starting point, one that is likely going to impact sort of classics of all ages and all sort of genres as well.
Absolutely, and this is a really important part of why we're talking about the election today. It's not just about, you know, thinking all politics doesn't necessarily affect me, you know, my classic car hobby. Actually, what happens, you know, in the corridors of Westminster and, you know, in the rooms of Whitehall can have a very real impact on how we enjoy our classics as an enthusiast-driven hobby, and also how the wider classic car movement contributes to not only Britain's heritage, but also its economy as well. So getting the DVLA is having a wider review at the moment of its activities. This has been going on since last year. This call to evidence is a really important part of it, and it's been many years since the DVLA has really had this much dialogue with the classic car movement. So it's really important that the thousands of people who have already responded to this particular call to evidence, they, you know, the new people, whoever picks up the keys to number 10 this week, we make sure that that is listened to and responded to in due course.
I think it's interesting to think of the classic car community is a bit of a whipsock for the rest of the motoring community as well. It's a point we'll certainly touch on with one of our later examples, because it's a small population. It's easy to sort of look at it as a whole and get a sort of measure as to what's going on, and then sort of almost extrapolate that out through the rest of the motoring world. We'll definitely get to that later on, but in fact, we'll get to it now, really. Another one of the points is sort of ULEZ, emission zone charging. We've seen this sort of impact younger classics with historic statuses. It's a politically sensitive one. It seems to sort of swing from sort of one side of the scale to the other every now and then. But there's been events that have been impacted by this as well.
Absolutely. So, I was reading in some of the tabloids earlier this week about the idea that if Labour get in, there could be nationwide ULEZ zones. I'm not sure that that's necessarily what's going to happen, but it does, again, have an impact on how people enjoy old cars and how they contribute to the nation's heritage. So with most of the city centre emission zones, including the ULEZ zone in London, historic vehicles are exempted than they have been since those zones have been introduced. But what that does mean is that actually the younger cars that don't quite qualify yet, we're talking about sort of late 80s, 90s cars in particular, and they form a very big part of Britain's classic car movement. They're often being sort of penalised almost for taking part in events in cities, and that has had a genuine impact on some of the long-running events that are held within Britain's cities. So the Bromley pageant, that was called off this year, and they cited ULEZ as being the direct reason why. We know that the London to Brighton mini run, that was called off as a result of the ULEZ because it was no longer feasible. We know that the London to Brighton classic car run, which CCW is a media partner for, they moved their start, used to start from Greenwich Park, just opposite Canary Wharf, but now that's been moved out of London into Brooklyn's Museum, and that again was in direct response to make to the ULEZ, and that was to make sure that owners of younger cars could still take part in the run. Classics on the Green was another one that was just outside London in Hertfordshire, but again they found that because of the changes to ULEZ, it no longer made that event viable. So again, it does have a genuine impact on the hobby.
I think one of the things, certainly from the aspect where I see it as well as a younger classic car enthusiast, is the generation of cars that people my age have a nostalgia for aren't ones that have the sort of full historic status yet. And generally speaking, people my age tend to live in more urban built-up environments that are subject to ULEZ sort of charging for emissions, which means that all of a sudden you can't sort of have a classic car or a car that you sort of deem as classic or historically interesting because of where you live, because you're hit with the immediate charges. So it's one of those things that's an interesting stranglehold to the hobby, and again is a political hot potato, but one that is strangely tied to classics and strangely important. And yeah, like you said, when it comes to events, it's had a bit of a dent, but equally the market has had a bit of an impact through it as well.
Absolutely, and it's interesting because when I had an MGB GT and a Reliance Imagine, I could zip in and out of the centre of London, no problem, because again, both those were strike vehicles, they were ULEZ exempt. Now I've got a car that's got a Mark 1 Mazda MX-5, if I want to take that into London, it's £12.50, and that's before you pay the congestion charge. So again, it doesn't necessarily preclude me from owning a classic and live in London, but it does make it more expensive. So again, that again does affect the way the market operates. We have seen in our classifieds cars being openly advertised as ULEZ exempt because they know that people in big cities are more likely to buy them. And we've also seen, conversely, I've seen a slew of articles sort of in the wider media suggesting that people go out and buy an historic vehicle specifically because they can go in out of London. And using a vehicle of that age, yes, you could in theory go and buy an old Jag XJ6 as a commuting vehicle, but that's not really what the classic car movement and enjoying a car and preserving it as a piece of heritage is necessarily what it's about.
Yeah, it's preservation of heritage, not an exploitable loophole. Although I think London traffic would be certainly visually improved if all of a sudden everyone was putting around in sort of Austin Westminster's. We'll move on from ULEZ then to another sort of sore point really for the classic car community, and one that has been sort of glossed over, thankfully, for the past few sort of election years, which was, of course, the scrappage scheme. And none of the main parties have really mentioned this, but previous Labour governments have brought in sort of the old scheme, and it led to a lot of classics getting scrapped. I think I've still got floating around on my computer the sort of reams of details of all the interesting cars that were lost to that scheme. And a 2017 petition shows there's an appetite for protecting classics from the scrap heap, but with sort of changing environmental sort of opinion, this could be something we see sort of being resurrected, unfortunately.
It's an interesting point because again, the last national scrappage scheme was rolled out in 2009 when Gordon Brown was Prime Minister, and we did see quite a demonstrable effect on the number of classic cars that were being scrapped at the time. You know, being traded in because people wanted, it was the cash for clunkers scheme as it was called. People trading them in, getting a bit of money off a new car, but people were trading in, for example, 7 Morris Marinas they were got rid of, 10 Mazda RX-7s, 6 BMW 8 Series, 4 Citroen CX-es, there were 655 Minis, 81 Morris Minors, 45 Jaguar XJS's, 88 Citroen TCB. So it gives you a sense of just how vulnerable older classics can be. And it was a very famous case a couple of years ago where in a manufacturer-led scrappage scheme, someone wanted to trade in a very nice standard 10 for a discount on a new Transit. So there's a genuine risk if a scrappage scheme is reintroduced that classic cars could be sent to the scrappers rather than being broken up for parts or saved by enthusiasts. So it's very important that I think legislation is introduced to protect particularly historic vehicles from being traded in on these schemes. I think it's much more valuable to enthusiasts for these cars to either be put back on the road and restored as pieces of motoring heritage, or at the very least given to clubs, broken up and used as parts to help protect other classic cars from the same fate. So it's a very important piece of potential legislation, and it's relevant because Labour have previously talked about the potential of bringing in another scrappage scheme. They mentioned this 2 years ago at their party conference. So I think it is something that is certainly something to be mindful of as enthusiasts, and if that is talked about in the future, whoever gets the keys to number 10, I think it's something that enthusiasts we should be beating the drum about and making sure that classics are protected.
I remember early on in my tenure at CCW was you sent me off to try chase around the Labour Party and try and find out a bit more about when they'd sort of floated the idea of a new scrappage scheme, and they were sort of a bit reluctant to give any details on it. I think as soon as sort of shots came across the bow, they might have backed down from it a little bit, and one hopes that they have completely. But the idea of sort of scrapping cars, or at least offering them up as a better means of preservation of other cars, or putting them into museum pieces, even if it means they're coming off the road, but there's still this ability to preserve Britain's heritage. They form a huge part of the fabric of quintessential British life. When you sort of think about what foreigners think of the UK, very often it is thought of as sort of, not necessarily old and stuffy, but certainly older classic cars as sort of, it's a large part of what people think about as being part of Britain. And when it comes to preserving that, we also need to think about how the next generation gets involved when it comes to things like apprenticeships. And apprenticeships are a government-led scheme. Obviously, whoever forms the next government is going to have a say in how those are put together and how they're run. And there's a huge amount of classic car and sort of hands-on apprenticeships that are, I wouldn't say at risk, but certainly will be put under the limelight when it comes to a new government.
Absolutely. And the historic vehicle movement in the UK supports more than 34,000 jobs. So it's a big contributor to the UK economy. And one of the ongoing issues is the fact that obviously the generation of restorers and specialists and painters and all these other people who are very, very skilled at what they do, they are coming up to the age where a lot of them are retiring. And so one of the big challenges for the classic car movement is finding ways to train up new experts to replace those skills, and to do so at a rate where it replaces the rate of those who are retiring. And that's been an ongoing challenge. And certainly a lot of the experts I've spoken to in the industry have said that government's doing more to support apprenticeships, particularly where technical skills are involved, is something that I think it would be a really valuable way of actually helping to ensure the future of the movement. And it's also about making sure that these young enthusiasts actually have really good, valuable careers to go on to. You look at, if you punch in classic car jobs into Google, there are loads of roles out there for restorers and technicians and so on. And they pay pretty good wages as well, because there is a shortage in the industry. It's very competitive out there because there is a shortage of people coming into the industry with those skills. It's really important that the work that sort of the likes of the Heritage Skills Academy and Starter Motor and so on, these are bodies who help to train the next generation up in how to do things like restoration and panel beating and so on, that they are given as much support as possible to help ensure that the cars that we love stay on the road for years to come.
And equally, in the broader scheme of things, these are sort of transferable skills you'll pick up as a sort of heritage vehicle technician. Obviously, things like sort of automotive wiring, sort of putting in fuel lines, brakes, maintenance, those are all things that are still relevant to modern cars. They all still have brakes and steering systems. And equally, as we look to preserve the life of existing cars and sort of recycle and sort of reuse and sort of make things a lot more sustainable, those are skills that are going to be in demand. So these are valuable apprenticeships and valuable skills that the classic car community is looking to instill into the next generation. I think it's worth sort of bearing that in mind and sort of hoping it's not overlooked on the case of, oh, well, it's just all about sort of panel beating and making a nice ash frame for something. It's a lot broader than that. And again, like you said, this forms a huge part of the working community. 34,000 jobs is not insubstantial. And ensuring that is sort of kept going is going to be valuable not only to the workforce but also to the wider British economy.
Absolutely, and it's there are certainly, we have some well known cheerleaders for this in our industry, including Richard Hammond as a very prominent example. But again, they are talking about getting more people in again to keep these wonderful old cars on the road. One of the things which I'm always very conscious of as well is that classic cars are the ultimate form of recycling. It's much better for the environment to keep an old car on the road and restore it and love it than it is to keep banging out new ones every year all the time, because that's a massive impact on the environment. But we need more people in the industry to do that. So these are really transferable skills. And it's about making sure that we are banging the drum for this in schools and colleges, that we get the next generation into use as early as possible.
Yeah, hopefully that'll be something that we get to carry on with. One of the big things that everyone knows with classic cars, we sort of mentioned it with you, Les, is tax exemption. But equally, there is another level to this, and it's certainly something we mentioned recently. The FBHVC has still got its ambition to roll out a 30-year-old sort of tax exemption, sort of extending it a bit further. And there's been petitions put to government, and they've all passed 10,000 signatures, but they've all been rejected. So I want to sort of ask you the question, why should the hobby get a tax cut?
So I think it's a difficult and nuanced question, that, but certainly the FBHVC's ambition, not necessarily demand, but ambition, is that eventually classic cars, when they hit the age of 30 years old, should be recognised. Their definition of an historic vehicle is when it reaches the age of 30 years old, and their ambition is that the current rolling tax and MOT exemption is extended to cars that are 30 years old. However, it is a difficult one to justify necessarily at this particular point, because there's a cost of living crisis on right now. So what we don't want to do is necessarily go and banging the drum asking for what is essentially a tax cut on a hobby at a time when people are struggling to pay their bills. So it's about making sure that we do this. If we are going to do that, that we do it at the point when the timing is right, and also do it in a way that doesn't bring in any restrictions on use as well. So you think about what happens in Germany. They have an historic class of vehicle as well. But then number plates, for example, will have H on the end of them to designate that they are. So it's a change straight away in the appearance of the vehicle. There are also limitations on condition, on mileage. Also, it's a lot stricter. Whereas obviously for us, it's all about making sure that people are free to enjoy that these wonderful pieces of motoring heritage as best they can, so they can carry on going to events and so on, so they're not being limited in how they use their classics.
Yeah, there's a lot of important balances really to be struck there. I think it's worth keeping the discussion on that one going forward and keeping things open, and certainly listening to experts within the field, as well as sort of dealing with the people that make the laws, and sort of keeping that conversation flowing is going to be important.
So absolutely.
Steps in.
And the reintroduction of rolling tax exemption, I think, was a really valuable way of supporting the classic car movement. Helps keep cars on the road, it encourages people to get into the hobby and enjoy sort of younger classic cars as well. I think that's a much better way of doing it than the previous system, where it's cut off before 1st of January 1973. So we've seen a whole tranche of 70s classics over the past decade or so earn their historic stripes, and that's really good, because it now means that they're being cherished and restored in a way that they weren't before. It would be great if at some point in the future we could see cars that are being given that same love and protection when they reach 30 years old. But I appreciate that it is a delicate balance to strike for whoever gets into number 10.
Overall, though, I think this sort of argument for there to be it sort of extended to 30, as it were, is a great sign of health for the sort of hobby as it is. It shows that there is this passion for sort of motoring and preservation and keeping things going, which is overall what the sort of hobby is all about. So if that is sort of out there for cars, it's a great sign. But one of the things that we've sort of touched on every now and then, I know certainly when the rollout of E10 arrived, there was a bit of a discussion around this. And this is protection grade fuel. Obviously, classic cars prefer running on E5, slightly lower ethanol content is better for older sort of fuel lines and fuel systems, and equally just for slightly older sort of styles of combustion. It's at the moment only guaranteed on forecourts to 2026. obviously there's a huge amount of sort of business and finance attached to the world of sort of petrol marketing and everything, and prices are set to go up again, unfortunately. But there's a lot of questions around this one as well.
Yeah, so it's, you know, when the E10 was rolled, the E10, so this is 10% ethanol in fuel, was rolled out, which is 2021. I think there was concern initially about what would happen to to classics that couldn't necessarily run very easily on this higher ethanol petrol. And it was, again, thanks to lobbying by the likes of the FBHVC, it was great to see that E5, the lower ethanol petrol, was kept on the forecourts. Usually, when you go and you buy supreme, sort of premium style petrol, that would usually have the lower ethanol content, which is a really good thing, because it meant that when you pulled in on the forecourt, you had a choice as to what you wanted to do. So, and it meant that classic cars could carry on being driven around without necessarily needing to change their fuel lines and so on. And when that was rolled out, the status quo was that it would be on sale for at least 5 years. Everyone I've spoken to has said that it's almost certainly going to be extended again beyond 2026, but it's something, again, to be caught, that the whoever comes in on Thursday will need to be conscious of. For my money, I think it's well worth keeping E5 in premium grade petrol and keeping the current status quo, because everybody wins. You get the lower emission, the lower carbon emissions from E10 through the vast majority of sort of petrol sales being through the cheaper E10. Classics typically only drive about 1,200 miles a year. They're responsible for less than 0.25% of the UK's vehicle emissions. So I think for what it's worth, I would keep it as it is. But again, that's something that if anybody does talk about changing it, that's where we need to make sure that the classic car owner is being represented in years to come.
And weirdly enough, I think almost Big Oil, to sort of coin the phrase, would have our backs on this one, because for them, they've got a sort of a second marketable product that they can have a little bit of a markup attached to, and they'll be pressuring to sort of keep it on the forecourt as well, because for them, it's great for their profit margins. But equally, when we're talking fuels, we're looking for a bit more support for synthetics and sustainable fuels as well. We've seen a great sort of growth in that sector of the market, but nowhere near as big as it needs to become quite as mainstream. I think Revival is running it later this year at Goodwood. They've done showcase races previously where it's all been fueled by it, but this year, every car that we're taking part of the Revival will be sustainably fueled. We're sort of looking to see something change so everyone can start moving towards that.
Yeah, I think that's a really bold step being taken by Goodwood at this year's Revival. Every single car that wobbles through the chicane and the St. Mary's Trophy will be doing so on sustainable fuel, which is effectively carbon neutral, which I think is a really important development, because it means that we can enjoy our hobby in a way that we can actually say that we are part of the solution, not be castigated necessarily as part of the problem. So I think that's a really important step. I know that other organisations are doing a lot of work with this. The Vintage Sports Car Club are doing events already, which involve synthetic fuel. Mazda runs the cars and its press fleet on synthetic fuel as well. The problem we have at the moment is that it's still very much work in progress, and the big problem for the likes of you and me is that synthetic fuel currently costs around £4.60 a litre, I believe it is. I know you ran one of Mazda's cars that's for a feature earlier this year in Classic Car Weekly entirely on synthetic fuel, and filling it up wasn't cheap.
No, it was well over, I think it was £160 at least for a tank of fuel for a Mazda MX-5. It is not a cheap fuel to use, but ultimately it is well designed and well proven enough that you can drop it into any car. I've run the Mazda on it, I've run a couple of rally cars on it, I've run my personal MG Midget on it as well. I have no qualms using it, and if anything, the cars seem to be a little bit happier on it, because it was sort of designed to burn well in an older engine. So it's a great sort of science, it's a great application of it, and equally classics can be seen as this great test bed for sort of furthering science and sort of furthering eco-conscious motoring. But at the same time, it does need some sort of a reduction in duty, some or sort of government support for its development, just to push it that next step along.
Absolutely. This is, again, a really potentially quite important piece of the jigsaw when it comes to supporting synthetic fuel, which is making it cheap enough that regular classic car owners would want to put it in their tank. Certainly, I'm quite happy to run my MX-5 on premium grade fuel, but I'm not sure I'd necessarily every single week want to put petrol that costs £4.60 a litre into my car, because I'd be broke within the next month. So maybe there's a way of supporting it, maybe cutting the duty or the VAT on it or something, you know, as a way of encouraging and spurring on the development and the take-up of a fuel that's much better for the environment in the long run.
Yeah, I think as we see more and more events showcasing it, and more classic owners that have the financial sort of ability to do it as well, and sort of keep talking about it, we'll keep moving it more and more towards the spotlight. It's something we want to see happen, because ultimately, anything along those lines that helps preserve our hobby and keep our cars on the road in a way that we can enjoy the sight, sound and smell of them, that's going to be crucial as the years go by. But keeping them on the road is going to be an interesting challenge, especially if the roads themselves start changing. And we won't get into a moment about potholes and conditions of tarmac, but more interestingly, the actual technology of the road itself, and smart motorways are a big flaw here.
Oh, don't get me started on smart motorways. I think they're an absolutely terrible idea, and virtually every classic car owner and club I've spoken to is with me on this one. I think that the idea of having a 70 mile an hour motorway where there is potentially nowhere at all for you to stop, and this applies to new cars as well, if you get a puncture or an electrical fault or something like that, there's nowhere to stop other than in a live lane of a 70 mile an hour motorway, is absolutely lunatic from my point of view. And we've seen, the BBC did that excellent Panorama documentary a year or so ago, where they showed that actually the cam technology monitoring, it doesn't necessarily pick you up straight away. We've seen cases, we know that potentially these smart motorways are lethal, and I am pleased that the outgoing government introduced a moratorium on them. I think that whoever gets in to number 10 on Thursday needs to take a serious look at them and ban them completely outright.
Yeah, I think you're right when you say that this doesn't just impact classic motorists. Obviously, by nature of our cars being old, I think it's not unfair to say we're more susceptible to motoring maladies while on the road. But as you say, this impacts modern motorists as well. Punctures are just more and more common these days as tyre technology shifts. But equally, collisions, the amount of times that I've seen modern cars stuck at the side of active motorways is grown exponentially in the past few years. I've got my own suspicions as to why that is. I won't get into it. But the fact is that this is something that impacts all drivers. And it wasn't until I myself got stuck on a smart motorway that eventually a policeman arrived and said, "Have you not phoned the police?" And I was like, "No, because I thought the camera picks me up." And he goes, "No, they're supposed to start telling you that the idea is you now phone the police, and then they let Highways Agency know to close the lane."
Which is a terrifying prospect in itself. And certainly your point, absolutely. Yes, classic cars, they break down, of course they do. But equally, the last breakdown I had was in a brand new Mercedes A-Class. So these things can and do happen. And the idea of having traffic, you know, potentially behind you at 70 mile an hour while it happens is a frightening prospect. I think the AA came up with a very good proposition ahead of this year's election, which was essentially to turn that lane, that inside lane on the smart motorway, back into a hard shoulder and then have the gantry reopen it for emergencies only. That was their proposition. I think it's a very sensible one, and I think that whoever's in government end of the week should look at it and take it seriously. Yeah,
do very well to essentially invert the way it's run at the moment, which is it's run as a live lane and then swapped to closed in an emergency. Keep it all the time closed, and when
flip it on its head, exactly.
Open it up if you need to. I think that'd be a great one for safety. And equally, there's other bits of technology that are being implemented into our roads. Potential requirements for things like black boxes. We've seen the rollout of noise cameras. There is going to be a clash between sort of modern technology and the classic interface, because you simply can't sort of have older cars with modern exhaust systems fitted so they comply with noise regulations. You haven't got the wiring setups to support black boxes. Black boxes themselves are a bit of an electrical draw. Older cars don't necessarily have the best wiring. Trust me, I know that. And it's there is going to be this sort of ongoing clash as governments go, cars need to have this, and we go, yeah, but my car simply can't because it was designed in the 1960s. There's going to be a problem, and it needs someone in power to have a bit of an understanding, I think.
It's, I had a very interesting conversation with Jacob Rees-Mogg once, and I'm not suggesting you do or don't vote for Jacob Rees-Mogg, but he did say that legislation, when it's introduced, should not be introduced retrospectively to cars. So things like a Jaguar E-Type or an Austin 7, they were completely compliant with the laws when they were introduced. We shouldn't be introducing legislation that then retrospectively makes something that they do illegal. So we should still be able to go out and enjoy a car, you know, on a road, on a public road, regardless of how old it is, as long as it's, you know, it still meets the standards of when it was made. So again, things like black boxes, I don't think that necessarily would work with classic cars. The technology is not compatible. Equally, yes, there have been trials of noise monitoring equipment. This is designed to catch out people, motorbikes with illegal exhaust, that sort of things in residential areas. But that shouldn't stop you. If you put something like a TVR or Ford Capri, if you start up, yes, it's going to be a bit throaty when you start it up. That doesn't make it illegal. As long as it's standard, you should not be caught out by new equipment.
Yeah, and I think there's got to be a balance struck between sort of it. And equally, I think safety is worth sort of considering it. I think that a lot of people bemoan adding seatbelts to cars. And weirdly enough, there have been cases where seatbelts have been added to classic and heritage cars. And it has, and the DVLA has gone, oh, yeah, well, that's a modification. So cube plate. You go, well, no, hang on. I think there's, again, it's this sort of idea, this idea of conversation and balance to be struck between sort of a safe and sensible addition to a vehicle versus one that clearly makes no sense at all, i.e. trying to fit a black box to an Austin 7. Where do you start? And can you get one that runs on that lower voltage? I don't know. Where do you fit it? But anyway, it's one of those things that's worth considering and worth sort of, it brings us to the summation point of ensuring the conversation between classic enthusiasts and the overarching agencies and departments of government that sort of legislate these things, that conversation still needs to flow. And crucially, whoever takes the keys to number 10, it needs to be sort of ready to sit down and talk and listen.
Absolutely. And coming back to the conversations about the DVLA and the great work that's been done, you know, thousands of enthusiasts have shared their views on that. It's that kind of dialogue that needs to carry on. So it's really important that the historic vehicle movement and the interests of wider, more modern classics as well are listened to by the current government. It's worth remembering that the historic vehicle movement in this country is worth £7.2 billion a year. There are more than 1.5 million historic vehicles on Britain's roads, and they play a hugely important part in the nation's heritage. People, you know, people go to shows across the country. We know that millions of people go to these events, they look at these cars, they enjoy seeing them, and they have a feel-good factor, and they show, as you mentioned before, visitors to the country what Britain is all about and what makes us tick at the end of the day. You know, it's about showcasing all of that, all the joy of going to an evening meet, of going to car shows, of bringing footfall into city centres, making sure all of that could be safeguarded by whoever has the keys to number 10 at the end of the week. So again, it's all about carrying on talking, making sure enthusiasts are being listened to, and again, respecting the fact that decisions taken in Whitehall and Westminster can have a very real impact on our hobby for years to come.
Yeah, I think that brings us to a very nice conclusion. And obviously, make sure you get out there, put a tick in a box. It's your sort of right to do so, but bear in mind exactly what, like you said, this is your hobby and it's yours to vote for and protect. So think wisely, and we'll hopefully be back with another podcast soon. We'll try and make this a bit more regular, as it's quite fun sitting down having a proper chat.
Absolutely, yeah, definitely.
So we'll be back, and obviously make sure you've picked up the latest issue of Classic Car Weekly to never miss a thing, or even better, subscribe and free UK delivery, and you'll never miss a copy that way either.